Accession number 32297, reel 25.
John Dixon, reel 25.
Yes, good morning, Richard. What I would like to quickly recap, things come back to your mind, don't they? When we were back in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, as it now is, again, there was a little lull. Nobody quite knew where we were going or what we were going to do. They had to keep us amused, so they sent us, that's the air crew from the squadron, off to the mountainous inland region to do a jungle survival course, which none of us relished, but I think we learnt quite a lot. There was it was run by a character who called himself a squadron leader, but he was he'd obviously gone native. I think he was a pre-war rubber planter or whatever, and he lived there. He got a long ponytail, so you didn't see too many squadron leaders with long ponytails. But he said he was a squadron leader. I don't remember how he was ever paid, but we used to take a crate of whiskey up whenever people went up there. And he lived up there, and he got six wives. At least he said they were all his wives. But they all seemed to have smiles on their faces, so obviously life was quite pleasant. While we were there, we learnt how to survive in the jungle. There were vines hanging from trees. You got your machete and you slashed the vines, and water came out, so you could always, well, hopefully you could always find enough to drink. We were taught how to catch a snake with a forked stick, which you pronged into its behind its neck and pinned it to the ground, and then with your knife or your machete you chopped its head off and sliced the skin off, and you could cook it. That's provided you could build a fire. But anyway, all these things, we were only there for 4 or 5 days, and at the end of the test we had to go. They took us by truck out into the wilder parts, and we were given a certain amount of time to find our way back to base, using the skills that we've been taught as to how you find a stream. You follow the stream becomes a river, the river becomes a sea, and this is how you find your way out of the jungle. But we were told, you know, we were just being told to get ourselves back to base, and we were in this sort of blacked out truck, and we went as crews, and I can remember the sunlight filtering through the cover of the truck, so we got a pretty fair idea which direction we were heading in, and then they sort of came to a bit of a clearing and we were dropped off one crew at a time and told to find our way home. We waited till the truck had gone, and I thought, well, the quickest way to get back home is to follow the road back the way we'd come. And I think we were back quicker than anybody else. We were reprimanded for not doing the job properly, but I thought I'd use my initiative in finding the way back. Anyway, it was all a bit of fun. So that was the jungle course, we were given these wonderful things that we called ghoulie chits, were like nylon scarves with a huge Union Jack, which you're supposed to wear this under your flying overalls, Union Jack, and then printed on it basically was a message saying, I am a British aviator. If you find me and restore me to my colleagues or people in command, you will receive much gold. Now, this was the message in English, but it was printed on this scarf in 15 different languages and dialects, so that wherever you fell down into the jungle, there should be somebody that could read this. To me, I thought it was a huge joke. Shouldn't really say that, should I? But, I mean, bearing in mind that if you had fallen into the jungle, you can almost guarantee that the natives who found you would have probably also found a notice pinned on a tree from the Japs saying, whatever the Brits are offering you, we'll double it, sort of thing. Or, more importantly, as we spent 90% of our time flying over the sea, I did ask myself, I wonder if the sharks could read these messages that were printed on this scarf. Anyway, enough of that.
So we were really with you in Hong Kong, weren't we? At the
Yeah, we were in Hong Kong. We came out of there. We were there till the 28th of December 1945. We'd finished getting the colony back on its feet. We can't pretend it was perfect, but it was a jolly sight better than when we arrived. And it was time to sail away. During the last 2-3 months of our stay in Hong Kong, we did actually get the aircraft ashore, and we were flying, quite intensively. Looking at my logbook, I'm quite surprised. I often wonder what we did, but we were doing things like searching for mines, floating mines. We were patrolling the borders. We were being homed out onto any British ships that were coming in, and sometimes we attacked them and took photographs of them. HMS Glory, Implacable, Kemp and Felt, Black Prince, they're all in my logbook, the ships that were coming in and out of Hong Kong, and we just went and played with them, basically. So it was quite an interesting time. There was another special flight, or I just could mention two. One occasion I was told that I had to take two VIPs up to Canton. There's an airfield there called White Cloud Airfield, and of course this was all now Nationalist China. And I was warned that the Chinese Nationalists, although they were really on our side, as it were, it was very, very touchy. They didn't like us intruding into their airspace. They certainly didn't want the British extending their colonial empire. So I was told to be very, very careful. I took these two passengers up, and it turned out that when I loaded them into the Barracuda at Kai Tak, which is where we were based in Hong Kong, of course, it turned out that one was the bishop and the other one was his aide. What do you call a bishop's aide? I can't remember. Anyway, they climbed into the back of my Barracuda, and they were wearing their long flowing vestments. I had to tell them, I gave them helmets, told them how to plug in, and I tried to explain to them in simple terms what they'd have to do if we ran into trouble and if they'd had to jump out or anything like that. But they were completely silent. They hardly said a word during the whole trip. And I wrote in a little diary that I was keeping at the time. Obviously, they were relying on divine intervention if something had gone wrong. Anyway, we went up to Canton. White Cloud Airfield was just an old dusty bit of... Well, there was hardly any grass on it. It was just a stretch of land. They provided me with an escort of two of our corsairs, who circled around up above in case there was any trouble. Sure enough, as soon as I landed and taxied over to where there were some huts, these Chinese soldiers came out very purposefully, pointing Tommy guns at me and making great signals with their hands that I should not switch the engine off. I'd keep the engine running and I could just let my passengers out. Which, of course, they did get out. But if you can imagine Bishops and his aide getting out with long flowing vestments, with the propeller turning and all the dust from the airfield blowing up their undergarments, it wasn't terribly dignified. But I got them there. I took off again immediately and joined up with the Corsairs, who flew back down the Pearl River at a very low altitude. I was just tagged along behind, minding my own business, but these Corsair lads were charging down the river. I think they were trying to blow the junks over. Anyway, we got back, so that was quite an exciting trip. And there was one other trip I do remember. We used to there used to be some US Navy people around, and we took a couple of their ratings up for just for a jolly round one day. And another time I took them up and I got completely lost. The northeast of Hong Kong, there's wonderful, beautiful scenery, lovely little bays and green covered hillsides. And I was fascinated with just looking at all this lovely scenery. And I realised I didn't quite know where I was. And I couldn't seem to raise anybody much on the radio, or we didn't, I don't know whether we had a radio beacon. Anyway, I did what I, because I got no navigator with me, so I was on my own, but I managed to find my way back. And I can remember now, it's absolutely vivid, flying into Hong Kong Harbour. The sun was just beginning to set. There was the most gorgeous, wonderful sunset. I was so relieved to come back without getting into further trouble. And I can remember flying into this gorgeous sunset and landing with huge relief and getting back in time for the bar to open. Anyway, that was our stay in Hong Kong, and it's some very, very happy memories.
Did you come back directly to the UK from Hong Kong?
Oh no! What happened then? We strangely enough, that the ship was being. I still find this a little bit confusing. The ship was being used mainly for troop transporting, and they'd built into the hangars lots and lots of bunks and places for returning prisoners of war to get their heads down. We had several ladies that came back down to we were going back from Hong Kong to Sydney, but on the way down, we couldn't fly the aircraft on board because they'd got the deck so cluttered up with all this stuff that they were preparing for these troops and people coming back. So our aircraft were lightered out. They were taken out on lighters and they were craned on board. We stopped on the way down at Labuan, which is in Borneo, if I remember correctly, and there were whole loads of Australian ex-prisoners of war in a pretty bad way. A lot of them were in pretty dire conditions and needed medical attention, but all they wanted, of course, was to get back home to Australia. So we filled the ship up with all these poor people, it was terribly crowded. Now the point that I was making, I just cannot remember how we did it, but when we finally got down to Sydney, which was on the 12th of January 1946, we somehow flew the aircraft off. So they must have cleared the deck to do it, but I can't truthfully remember how we did it. I did one trip I do remember when I had a chap called Bill Williams, who was my observer, in the back seat, and I had two passengers. Now, Barracudas only made to take three people up, but we had an observer and two passengers as well. All I can say is they must have been very small, very matey, very uncomfortable. But anyway, so I've got that in my logbook. When we get back to Sydney, we fly off to an airfield called Schofields, which is not too far out of the of Sydney, easily accessible into the main city by train. It was a funny sort of place. Again, it was one of these MONABs, Mobile Naval Air Base, had belonged to the RAAF, of course. And I think it was now called HMS Navarron or something like that, some strange name. And there we were. We arrived there 12th of January 46. Unbeknown to me or my chums, this was to be my last flight in a Barracuda. having flown 324 hours in them, just for the record. There can't be too many people that can say they did that. But so we flew ashore to Schofields, and we were given 3 weeks' leave. About time, too, if you remember. We'd sailed out of Sydney on VJ Day, and we thought it was time we celebrated. Anyway, 3 weeks' leave, and six or seven of us got on a train, and we went up to Katoomba in the Blue Mountains, which is a lovely, lovely part of the world, absolutely gorgeous. And we stayed in a very nice hotel, forgotten the name of it, and we spent most of our days on horseback. There was a sort of livery yard at the end of the street, and we hired these horses. Some of us could ride a little bit, others hadn't got a clue, but they were docile creatures. The hotel packed us up with lunches, which we had in sort of haversacks on our backs, and we just climbed on these horses and we just rode out into the bush, as it were, and spent the whole day just ambling round and really thoroughly enjoying ourselves, enjoying the scenery and the weather, and it was magical. We did a little bit of swimming while we were there. There's a little place called Blackheath, not too far away, with a swimming pool. I think we rather gave up on that after a bit because we couldn't find any young ladies to entertain us up there. But anyway, we had a thoroughly good leave, and well deserved, I would think. Back we came to Schofields at the beginning of February, and complete change. All the barracudas had gone. They'd been whisked away to Bankstown, where I think they were broken up or pushed over the side or whatever. We lost the barracudas, they'd gone. And in their place, there were the fireflies, which had been left behind by the three firefly squadrons that had been operating off the fleet carriers during the last few weeks of the war. These fireflies were there, and if you remember, when we'd been back at Burscough way back in 1944, we envied these chaps flying these fireflies, and now with the war well and truly over, they were ours. So we quickly learnt to fly them. The other thing that happened, that Cedric Coxon, our CO, he'd gone while we were on leave. He'd gone home to the UK, presumably. A lot of our senior air crew had also gone because they were coming up for demob. So it was a rather different sort of outfit that was left. We had a new CO called Wynne Roberts, who rejoiced in the name of Ropey Wynne Roberts, who had a heck of a job, because Cedric Coxon was, you know, a top-notch CO, and of course we didn't relate very quickly to a new bod coming in who we knew nothing about. But he made his mark, and we quickly learnt to fly the fireflies, and changed our role, because these were cannon-armed two-seat fleet fighters. So he seemed to think we ought to become fighter pilots, which was not really to our taste, well, not to mine particularly. But we learnt to cope with these aircraft and do aerobatics, and I thoroughly got to enjoy them.
Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of the Firefly as an aircraft, as you've done with other ones?
Well, a two-seater, monoplane. If anybody knows what a Hurricane or a Spitfire looks like, which I'm sure they do, it was on those lines, bigger, of course, had a Rolls-Royce Griffin engine, which was one better than the Merlin, so it had got ample power. It was armed. The ones we had were Firefly F1s or Night Fighter ones, and they were armed with four 20mm cannon, They could carry a certain number of bombs if we needed. And the ones that were equipped for night fighting had got a big radar bomb thing underneath the fuselage, and the observer's role was to home you onto any other so-called enemies and shoot them down. That was how it was meant to work. But of course, it was a different sort of role. We could fire rockets too. They had a pod that you could put underneath each wing, and you could take, I think, 4 rockets on each side. So we played with those. Not quite while we were in Sydney. This came a little bit later on. But it was a quite a fast aeroplane. I think probably you could get around 300 knots in it, whereas, of course, the Spitfire was up in the upper 300s.
How did it handle in comparison with, say, the Barracuda?
Very different. Oh, it was a different animal altogether. We had to forget all that we'd done with the Barracudas. It was much more powerful. You climbed much faster. You could get up to 26,000 feet, I believe, at one time I did, which meant you had to go onto oxygen, of course, once you got above 10,000 feet. But it was quite a nippy aeroplane. It had been used by the squadrons operating off the big carriers towards the end of the war. They'd had some success in shooting down one or two Japanese aircraft, but they were mainly used, and where they excelled was rocket firing, attacking ground targets with rockets. That was really the best role for them, I think. But of course, by then the war was over, so we weren't taking things too seriously, but we were. We became very proficient.
And how long were you then in Australia with this period?
Because not long. Well, say not long. We started flying Fireflies early in February. By, I think, about the 20th of March, having practiced deck landings, we finally sailed away to come home.
And with that, you know, when you say you learnt to fly at that stage, is it really just a matter of taking pilot's notes and just working your way around the aircraft to familiarise yourself with it?
Well, yes, that's all we could do then. We had there were no two-seater, no with two pilots, no versions like that. They came after the war. We did have them later on, but no, all you could do is, as you said, you've got your pilot's notes. The new CO we had, this chap Wynne Roberts, I think he must have flown Fireflies at some stage before he came to us, so he would have taken us one by one or just shown us how the various things in the cockpit worked. But I mean, once you know how to fly, it's just a question of which buttons to push and which ones to pull and how to operate the flaps and all that sort of thing.
So by March you were heading back to the UK, and you knew that, did you, at that stage? That's where you were going?
Well, we knew we were due to come home, yes, and I mean, some of us were not getting agitated, but I mean, we knew we were going to be demobbed at some time. Some of the lads who were senior to me had left the squadron and had come home. And there was one very sad story while we were in Hong Kong. One of the senior observers, a chap called Toby Tobias, was coming up for demob. And normally he would have waited for a troop ship or something to bring him back to the UK. But he got permission to do it on his own. So he hitchhiked and he'd get to wherever he could and hitch a flight in an aeroplane and by stages would come back across India and wherever and back to the UK that way. He had got all the way back to Paris. And he was on the last leg of his trip, I think in a Dakota or something, flying with the RAF, a trip that was going from Paris back to the UK, and the plane crashed and dear old Toby lost his life. When you think what he'd been through, and the war was well and truly over, he was on his way home, and just because he chose to hitchhike, he lost his life like that. And we didn't know that immediately, but when the news filtered out to us, of course, we were all terribly sad.
And was there a question for you of potentially staying on at that stage? Can you offer that?
This is a bit vague, this. Yes, I think there must have been. Well, I know there must have been, because a lot of some of the lads did stay on. What we were offered was an extended commission for 4 years, but you would obviously, in that period, you wouldn't progress much beyond a lieutenant. And at the end of 4 years, they told you you would leave with a gratuity of £500. Well, now, £500 doesn't sound a lot today, and it didn't really sound an awful lot in those days, because if you'd lost 4 years of your civilian career, £500 wasn't really going to help you. But I, looking back on it, I suppose I should have done it, because I'd gone straight from school. I didn't honestly know what I wanted to do as a civilian. All I knew is I love flying. So why didn't I stay in? But I don't know. I think I wanted to get back to Mum and Dad or something. But some of the lads who did stay in, they did progress, and one or two of them made quite senior ranks.
So did you, again, obviously from Australia, did you come straight back, or were there stop-offs on the...
Oh, no, we didn't come straight back. No, nothing like that. No, no, no. We sailed out of Australia in March. We didn't stop... we didn't stop. We were in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and it was hot, and it was horrible and sticky, and, you know, we weren't flying at that time, I don't think. No, I'm sure we weren't at that time. Anyway, they suddenly piped hands to bathing stations. We thought, well, how can we swim? Anyway, they stopped the ship in the middle of the Indian Ocean. They sealed all the heads, which are the loos, on the port side of the ship, so nobody could go to a loo on the port. And everybody jumped off the ship on the starboard side and swam around. Now, nobody had told us whether there could be sharks about. But anyway, we swam around, and then they'd let down climbing ladders for us to climb up, get back on board when we'd had enough. But there was an awful swell going, so you can imagine, you cling on to the bottom of a ladder, and within seconds you're about 20 feet under because you're in the cell. I found it extremely difficult, and I didn't think it was a very good idea, but we all swam, and somebody recorded in our squadron line book that we were the only squadron to swim halfway across the Indian Ocean.